The soul has gone far away from the Lord. She has to be shown. Now you have the human body and you must meet the Beloved. This is the Bhajan Ru Malik Tohid Dur on page 193. Again and again I remembered my meetings with my Beloved. My heart suffers when the separation happens. The garment of the soul has to be dyed in the Nam. You came promising that you would meditate on Nam. After coming into this world, you forgot. Don't forget, O soul, that you have to please the Beloved. For a long time you have been separated from the All-Owner and are far away from Him. Now, without the true Satguru, you are wandering from door to door. Get your faults forgiven if you want to please the Beloved. If I meet gracious Beloved Kripal, He will give His support to me, the drowning one. Oh, Ajay, you have to make your soul meet her true separated Beloved. The soul has gone far away from the Lord. She has to be shown. Now you have the human body, and you must meet the Beloved. Bhajan of Sanchi on page 193.
Rumal ke to hoi durenu samjanani Hun milia manas jamakant nupanani Rumal ke to hoi durenu samjanani Hun milie manas jamakant nupanani Menu murmur yada piya milana diyayani Meri dil nu dukda hove jipen judayani Menu murmur yada piya milana diyayani Meri dil nu dukda hove jipen judayani Meri ruda chola naam deve chiraganani Hun milia manas jamakant nupanani Rumal ke to hoi durenu samjanani Hun milia manas jamakant nupanani Tu karke veda naam japan da aini Tu vich duniya de aake yaad bulaini Tu karke veda naam japan da aini Tu vich duniya de aake yaad bulaini Kite bhul na javi ruha kant mananani Hun milia manas jamakant nupanani Rumal ke to hoi durenu samjanani Hun milia manas jamakant nupanani Tu kul malik to dur vich reech diye Hun sach sat guru bajo dar dar fir diye Tu kul malik to dur vich reech diye Hun sach sat guru bajo dar dar fir diye Tu bulla le baksha je kantre janani un miliyama na se jama kantanu panani rumalik toho idure nu samjanani un miliyama na se jama kantanu panani de mil jaye kirpal diyal piyarani menu dubdi nu adeve an saharani de mil jaye kirpal diyal piyarani menu dubdi nu adeve an saharani Jadiruda Satcha Vichariya Kanta Milonani Unamiliya Manasa Jama Kanta Nupanani Rumalike Toho Idure Nusama Janani Unamiliya Manasa Jama Kanta Nupanani Rumalike Toho Idure Nusama Janani Unamiliya Manasa Jama Kanta Nupanani
The soul has gone far away from the Lord. She has to be shown. Now you have the human body and you must meet the Beloved. Today is August 21st. 48 years ago today, Master Kripal Singh left the body for the last time. And on this particular day, I feel like reading some personal experiences of mine with the Master. You know, the thing that is most prominent in my memory when it comes to him is the incredible love and caring and respect and forgiveness that he invariably showered on all of us, including me. So this is an account, well, partly from the time and partly from with my reflections on it at a much later time, of my trip to India in January, February, March 1972, before the world tour. On this particular trip, it was not like the one before it or the one after it. You know, I titled this book that I'm reading from Stumbling Toward God. In this particular trip, there were more stumblings than in one small, short space than I can recall ever in any other. It was a tremendous learning experience. At the end, it was blissfully happy. But there were many, many points during it when I really felt like I was the world's first-class idiot. And you'll see why when I read this. As I said to the Sangat when I returned home, when you come into the presence of the Master, the one thing that's always true is that nothing is what you expect. Looking back on it, it's like a big kaleidoscope. Preconceptions broken, Master's greatness shown to me in ways I never really knew before. I went there full of self-importance. I had done all this work Master had assigned to me. I awaited further assignments, that kind of thing. Well, he was not displeased with anything. He didn't say anything, negative or positive. It took me a while to grasp. All he wanted to talk to me about was my own inner growth. He talked a lot about my attitude toward work. He said, when you talk to people, make sure that they understand that you are telling them from the level of your understanding only. Don't assert. Don't come on as though Master is saying it. He said, whatever you do, don't be the master of the work assigned to you. Know that you're working for someone else. Never forget that. Very strong. Among a number of memorable occurrences during this time, the initiation of Tibor Farkas stands out. Tibor was a young man from Romania, now living in Montreal, an architect by profession who had come to India to be initiated. As I say in a footnote, Tibor later settled with his family near Sant Bani Ashram in New Hampshire and became a lifelong friend and invaluable sevadar, contributing his expertise to the building of many of the ashram and school buildings and to the construction, establishment, and ongoing management of Piario Home, among many other things. We had returned to Sawan Ashram by this time from Manav Kendra. I'm picking up the narrative about halfway through the stay, this particular trip, and the first part was at Manav Kendra. We had returned to Sawan Ashram by this time, and Tibor joined us there. Although the master initiated most seekers at the time of the monthly satsang, he elected to initiate Tibor separately, probably due to language difficulties. At any rate, he asked me to help Tibor with his application and answer any questions he might have. Master, by the way, pronounced it Tiber, and he called him Tiber throughout, which I did. Kripal had set up an application form which included the writing of a brief autobiography by the seeker outlining his or her spiritual search. So Tibor filled out the form and wrote his life sketch. When he finished, I took it to the master. He looked at it, examined what he had written, and said, a long yarn. And he told me to bring Tibor. When I reached him, he asked me, did the master read my life sketch? I said, oh yes, he read it. When we got to the master's room, he looked at Tibor and said, first thing, I have not read your long yarn. Because of his schedule, he instructed Tibor in two separate days. He gave him the theoretical part, including the imparting of the mantra of five names, on the first day, and had him sit for meditation the second day. All the Westerners were allowed to sit in on the meditation, but he asked only Kurt Hilger, a disciple from British Columbia who was leaving that night, and me to sit in on the theory. So there were four of us sitting along a long table, the master, Tibor, Kurt, and me. It was a truly remarkable experience. I have, in one capacity or another, been present at thousands of initiations, but in many ways this was the most memorable. Master outlined the theory, gave him the mantra, answered Tibor's questions, and got up to go. As he did so, he looked at me in great good humor, eyes twinkling, and asked me, how did I do? I stared at him. He repeated with a broad grin, did I do all right? I stammered something incoherent and we all left. Of course, the master's question went straight to the heart of my own vanity. I was, in fact, aware that I read the instructions well, was proud of it, and judged other representatives for not giving the instructions as well as I did. Master, of course, knew that, although God knows I never told him, and was instructing me accordingly. I got it, but he did it so lovingly and was so funny that it didn't hurt a bit. To paraphrase Mark Antony, this was a master. When comes such another? Many, many other memorable things happened on this trip, but for me by this time everything was coalescing around one thought. I miss Judith. She was everywhere. She dominated my every thought. And I was ashamed. For one thing, as I mentioned above, it uncomfortably exposed my desire to come alone to the master's feet as supremely shallow and unrealistic. Earlier on in this account, part I didn't read, I explained that I wanted to come to India this time alone, as I had in 1969, because I had such a great trip in 69, I wanted to repeat it. And I thought that if Judith came with me, it would be very different. I didn't, of course, tell this to Judith, but we worked it out. She would have liked to have come. I didn't. I was too selfish and too preoccupied with myself to notice that. But in any case, I came. I mean, I said she had to look after the ashram, look after the children, all that. But anyway, as soon as I got there, the day I arrived, I was consumed with the fact that I missed her. It exposed my desire to come alone to the Master's feet as supremely shallow and unrealistic, although this was hovering just below the threshold of my consciousness. Much more out in the open was the thought, here I am with the Master, we're supposed to be above such things as attachment to wives. I was trying like anything to meditate, and through the grace of God, it was not entirely fruitless, but I missed her so much. There was a very special thing that Master did for me at the height of all this. He used to give darshan on his porch every night. This particular night, I could see that it was going to rain, so I wanted to go over early. I ran over just as the rain was starting. I got to the porch, and nobody was there but me, and Master came out the second I got there. He sat down just as though he was going to give darshan, even though there was nobody there but me. And he said to me out of the blue, I hadn't said a word, yes, what's on your mind? Speak up, heart to heart, so kindly. All during this time, Master was showing me, time and time again, how he knows our innermost thoughts. So he pulled me out like that, and I said, Master, I'm disgusted with myself because of the tiny amount of love that I have for you. He said, how can you measure love? How can you measure it? It's either there or it isn't. I said, well, when thoughts of outside things come up in meditation, my mind clings. He said, look here, when thoughts of wife and children come up, he realized I hadn't mentioned wife and children at all. When thoughts of wife and children come up, don't not love them. He was sitting in his chair. I was on the floor, and he was leaning, looking right down at me. Don't not love them. Love them for the sake of he who has given them to you. Then you'll be all right. I was speechless. I said, you can see the innermost thoughts of our heart, and yet you love us anyway. You love us anyway. He just laughed. He was so loving, so kind. Many times when he would talk to me, it would be like he was washing me with the gentlest kind of beautiful water. I would be shaking with happiness after just a few words like that. But the following morning, Master sent for me and told me that Judith was coming. He had gotten a telegram from her. He showed it to me. And in my such great wisdom, I thought, she's coming. Master is giving me this because I missed her so much. It would be far better if I could rise above this, and then she wouldn't have to come. So unbelievably, and this, what follows is, you know what, I couldn't ever for a long time tell anybody about this. I was so ashamed of it. I still am ashamed of it, but the first time that I ever said anything about this to anybody was 3 days after Judith died. I did a satsang, in addition to the memorial service, I did a satsang about, mostly about her experiences with the Master, that, as far as I knew them. And that's when I told this following story. And believe me, I cannot believe how incredibly stupid and obstinate and unbelievably unreceptive that I was, and you'll see. Unbelievably, I immediately tried to persuade the Master that she didn't have to come. I said, Master, there's a big time difference between here and there. So if we cable her not to come, she'll get in time and she won't come. He just looked at me. He said, she's coming. I said, but she doesn't have permission. Believe it or not. Yeah, believe it or not. He looked at me and said, she has permission. I said, believe it or not, no, I know she doesn't. He just looked at me with a pitying look, and he said, get me her file. I stared at him. her file. You know, I had been in the room in the ashram where the letter files were kept. There were millions of them. It was an enormous archive. I said, "Her file, Master?" He said, "Yes, it's in the living room." So I went in the living room, and there on a couch all by itself, nothing else of any kind in the whole room, there was Judith's file, her letter file, that had been taken out, and obviously Master had used it. I brought it to him, and he opened up to her last letter, which had been written before I left, and he said, "Read that, and you'll see that she asked me if she could come." I read it through, and there wasn't a word in it about coming to India, I promise you that. At this point, my mind was being pulled apart. I was reeling, so I said, "Master, there's not a word in here about coming to India." He took it and he read it through. He really concentrated, and when he finished, he looked at me and sighed. Well, not in an outward way, that's true. Suddenly, the whole thing came into focus. Then he looked at me and said, "Do you not think that I would like her to be here enjoying, like you are enjoying? Do you not think that it would be nice for her to be here with me, just like you are here with me?" You know, in my heart of hearts, I had wanted her to come so badly, but I had felt it would be such a failure on my part if it happened. It was such an egotistical way of looking at the whole thing. And he said it straight in just a second. She came, and it was wonderful to have her there. Her plane was delayed 24 hours, and in the meantime, Master had gone back up to Manavkendra. I met Judith at the airport, and we took a taxi up there. We were eager to see the Master when we found him walking around Manavkendra, supervising the construction that was still going on. When he saw Judith, the first thing he did was make a joke. And I should mention that Master often addressed Judith as, well, he pronounced it Edith. It would be the, in writing, it was the name we would say Edith. And he sometimes said, you know, in letters, he would, "Dear Edith," like that. We never found out the significance of this. When he saw Judith, the first thing he did was make a joke. He looked at us, looked at her, and said, "I heard the plane was delayed because Edith was too heavy," with a big smile. Then he took our two heads and pushed them together, clunk, so that they were touching, and he said, "This is the way I want you to be here, together." This is from a talk I gave when I got back. Our habit, even when we're with the Master, is to think always in our own terms, so that we ask questions and conversations take place in a frame of reference that is entirely of our own making. It is very rare for Master to violate that. It's like a game he plays. If you select a frame of reference, he'll play the game within that. But if you'd selected another one, you might find out a lot more. Or if you just leave it open to him, anything could happen. These are subtle things. In the Master's presence, there is nothing that cannot and should not and does not lead to growth. Nothing. You see, Master has two kinds of beauty. Actually, he has 50,000 kinds, but he has two main kinds. I'm talking about physical beauty. The first is his beauty near at hand, like when you're sitting on the floor about 6 inches away from him, and you're looking into his face, and you see every nook and cranny of the boulder that his face is, and you wonder how on earth God could create such a face as that. That's one kind of beauty, you see. And you're looking into his eyes. Sometimes I would look into them and my eyes would hurt, and I could only concentrate on one of his eyes at a time. I could not focus on both eyes at once. This also, by the way, that was my experience with Sanchi. I could only concentrate on one eye at a time. And I found it very difficult to answer him when he talked to me. I would have to avert my gaze for a second in order to make my mind work enough to come up with the answer that he wanted. Because it's really true that looking into his eyes, you begin to withdraw. There's no doubt about it. The withdrawal process starts. And all of that, that whole experience I found was exactly the same as Sanchi. The other kind of beauty is his beauty at satsang. He's sitting up there on the dais, and you may be quite a distance from him, no doubt, but he's sitting up there and he's a lion. That's his name, you know. Kirpal Singh means merciful lion. That's his name, and that's what he is. In those days in Meerut, this was Master went to Meerut and was holding satsang. I think this was before Judith came. He was sitting up there holding satsang in the most beautifully exquisite experience, is watching him, even if you don't understand a word, watching him make his points with his hands, the way he'd move his head. Sometimes he talks for 3 hours, more usually two. He never stirs from his waist down. From his waist up, he's swaying, he's looking, he's darting his eyes. He looks at the whole congregation, he notices everyone. He's so alive. You look at him and the life that's coming from him is so tangible. You think, oh my God, how beautiful. How much beauty can there be in the world? So that's what it was like at Meerut. At Manav Kendra, there's a little old woman that lives there. She looks about 90. She's all bent over with a big hump on her back. She walks around mumbling bhajans and moves very slowly with great difficulty with steps and things. And now, of course, I have a lot of personal experience. It was exactly what it was like for her to move. So one day we were all following Master along this path, and Master's walking very fast. He just floats along. Anyway, we were all coming along this path in a big cloud, following Master, and there was this little old woman up ahead, and there were 3 stone steps on the path, and she started to go up them with great difficulty. And Master, never even breaking his stride, just reached down and put his hand under her elbow, and it looked from behind as though he just lifted her up the 3 steps and set her on the top. And then he kept on going. She knelt right down on the ground and took the dust from where his feet had been and put it on her forehead. The way he did it, the whole feel of the thing, was just so beautiful. There were so many things like that. Sometimes there's a certain kind of Indian disciple who has a certain way of looking at the master, which to me is meaningful beyond words. It's a smile, but it's a smile that's so extreme that it seems like their face is going to break in two, and there's tears in the eyes along with it. Whenever you see that expression, you know that just being with the master is almost knocking them out. And Master was so loving to people like that. He pats them on the face. He sits right down with them. Judith and I had 3 lovely weeks together with Kirpal, and we grew closer together than we had ever been. Toward the end of the stay, we heard that the master was going to Pathankot, a town way up in the Punjab on the Pakistan border, and that he was going to take a few of the Westerners with him, including Millie Prendergast, Steve Mellick, Judith, and me. We were very happy until we learned that it was an 11-hour drive and we would not be in the master's car. I got very depressed. When I had gone with the master on tour previously, I had always ridden in master's car. Now an 11-hour drive through Indian backcountry without the master, I dreaded it. We all got loaded up and packed in and off we went. Couple of hours out, no sign of the master anywhere. Flat tire, called in India a puncture. We climbed out of the car while the driver went to work on the tire, turned around, and there he was. He had driven back specially to check on us. We were ecstatic. He gave Judith a big bunch of grapes and told her to distribute it as prashad. We all took 1 grape apiece. She ended up with all the rest. He hung out with us while the tire was being fixed, and then we started off again. Before the trip was over, there were 2 more punctures, and each time the master was there. When we arrived, I said to Judith, I was dreading this day, and it turned out to be one of the most beautiful days I have ever experienced. She agreed. We were not there very long before I got sick. The chronology is now hazy in my mind, but there were many things that might have contributed to it. The second night it was bitter cold and pouring rain, and Satsang was under a big tent, which was made up of little tents put together. I was sitting right under the crack where two of the tents supposedly connected, and I was rained on the whole satsang. I tried to move but couldn't. The place was too crowded. The following morning it was a bright sunny day, but still very cold. Again the satsang was absolutely jam-packed with thousands of people. We were all sitting on the ground cross-legged. I say in the book that it was all under a huge tent again, but my memory, as I think about it, I think this was a mistake on my part, as my memory is of being outdoors, and there were thousands of people there. I wasn't sitting with Judith because, you know, the men and women had to sit separately. It was so jam-packed that I could not move, or I had to sit straight up because if I moved, I couldn't move, period. And this is what I said about that satsang when I got back. There was a satsang the morning of our last day, and despite the fact that I was sick as a dog, I wanted to go to it. In both good and bad ways, that satsang was something. I was sick in a way that's almost indescribable. I was sitting cross-legged on the ground. In the morning it was cold, but as the day went on it got hot, and I was dressed for the cold morning with long underwear, etc. And as the day went on, I really began to stifle. Master gave the longest talk, without a doubt, that I've ever heard him give anywhere. 3 hours exactly, of which only a phrase or two were in English. And for the last 2 hours of that three-hour talk, I was in such intense pain that I had to sit absolutely straight, because any other position put too much pressure on me. With all that, Master's face was so beautiful. I was sitting there looking at it. Of course, I was way back in the crowd. I was not nearly up front at all. I was sitting there looking at it. I couldn't believe it. I kept getting sicker and sicker, yet I kept looking more and more at his face, and I realized I would rather be there than anywhere else in the world doing anything else. You see, you can't, pictures don't get it, movies don't get it, you have to see it with your own eyes. Everything about the master is so subtle, like when he makes a point, he smiles, just a little bit of a smile, and the subtle beauty of that smile just floats out across at your heart. In Pathankot, just before we left, Master sent for me, and I told him I couldn't believe that in 2 days' time we would be in the United States. He said, "Who says you are leaving? Who says? You'll take me with you. Wherever you are, I'll be there." And then he did something very interesting. He asked me if I needed money. Now, I have mentioned above how he had twice asked me if I needed money during the 1963 tour, and I turned him down both times. And I had mentioned this to Mary McTeer, and she had said, "Why shouldn't you take money from him? You take everything else from him." And I had thought about it and decided the next time the master offered me money, I would take it. So when Master called me in, I saw that he had his money box, a metal box in which he kept donations and American money, with him. He opened it up and said, "Do you need money?" I remembered what Mary had said, and I remembered my resolve. I still didn't want to ask for it, so I said, "Master, whatever you want to give me, I will take. It's up to you. I'm happy with whatever you want to give me." He said, "All right." And he counted out 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. "Is that enough?" I said, "Master, it's up to you. Whatever you want to give me, I'll take. 50, 60, 70. How about that? Is that enough?" I said, "Master, it's in your hands. Whatever you want to give me, I'll take." He kept on going, and I ended up with somewhere over $100, a very significant amount of money, much more so then than now, which I felt very funny about taking, but which he obviously wanted me to have. The sicker I got, the more receptive I got. I was physically so out of it, but I was feeling so much love for him. On the afternoon of the last day in Pathankot, Judith and I were in our room. I was wretchedly sick, and she was taking care of me. I had begged her to go and have darshan so that at least she should not waste our precious last day, but she refused on the grounds that I needed her. God knows it was true. I felt as if I was coming apart inside. It was just after the 3-hour satsang I described above, and I was, in addition to being very ill, utterly exhausted. I lay on the bed like a piece of dough. No life, no spirit, no anything. Suddenly I became aware that it was time to go and see the Master. This, by the way, one of the things about the Master and in my relation with him was he was very, very capable of speaking to me directly without, and I don't mean in meditation necessarily, or that, you know, or that I was seeing his form or anything. It was a telepathic thing. He could speak directly to my mind, and it was very obvious that it was him. There was no question about it. I became aware that it was time to go and see the Master, because he told me to. I got up off the bed and said to Judith, "All right, let's go over." On the way over, though, I got cold feet and began to be apprehensive. It's not a light or easy thing to knock at the Master's door and request admittance. Not for me, it isn't. Greatly do I prefer for him to ask me first. Then I know for certain that it is his will. So this afternoon I said to Judith, "I'm not going in unless someone in high position tells me it's all right." I was thinking of B.B.R. Devi or Mohan, Master's driver. But before I even had a chance to knock, the door opened and the Master himself was standing there. "Come in, come in," Judith said. "Is that high enough authority for you?" We went in and B.B.R. Devi was waiting with tea, our tea in cups, and a bunch of shawls, our farewell gifts, on her lap. The Master, in his great kindness, let us stay with him all afternoon. While he did not take away my illness, when I did leave him, I was as sick as ever. Somehow he worked it so that it did not matter while I was with him. In that love-filled afternoon at one of the farthest corners of India that he had called me to from a sickbed was without blemish. The next morning we had to leave him very early for the 11-hour drive back to Delhi to catch our plane home. We said goodbye to him before dawn. The last thing he did was to give me prasad, anison, and tea. We went and sat in the car, and once again I wept as though my body encased the flood. I cannot describe my feelings at parting from him. The deep, deep, deep grief. It is like no other sadness in the world. It is having to say goodbye to all your deepest and most cherished hopes. It is finding your reason for existence and then saying goodbye to it. It is turning your back on your original face before you were born. Such is the true guru, and such is the grief at leaving him. And, of course, could be argued that even that grief is a lack of receptivity because, as he had said to me earlier, who said you were leaving? Who says you are leaving? Who says you'll take me with you? Wherever you are, I'll be there. But both are true, and the Masters themselves feel this. You know, Sanchi wept for many days, many weeks maybe, after Kripal left. And Kripal himself has described how Sawan Singh wept at the thought of Jamal Singh coming back physically. And he said, "The Master is with me constantly and never leaves me for a second, but I would give everything I have in this world if I could sit at his feet physically once again." So both are true, and they represent two different perspectives, and they're both valid. Anyway, I want to finish by reading this excerpt from a letter that Master Kripal Singh wrote many, many years ago, which drives home the point that he doesn't leave. Who says he is leaving? Who says he is always with us? "Please learn to be receptive to his grace and feel his kindly presence riding with you on the buses, chatting with you in the street, sitting with you in the park, by your office desk, accompanying you every morning to the office, slowing down by the lily pond to check the new flowers, and walking with you in the evening all the way back by the new moon. Master is always with the disciple and never leaves him or her until the end of the world. The Father will never disown his children. We're going to hear a morning talk from Master Kripal, October 25th, 1967, the one called What is True Love? That is marvelous. Okay.
I was just talking about love, not the love that is the result of our outward enjoyments, physical enjoyments, not the love. No. Love is charity. You see? Charity word is more suitable than the word love. So this, everybody repeats, he loves God, yeah, he loves somebody. Now, how many there are really men who really know what love is? Love is the attraction of the heart. It is a question of matter of heart, not of head matter. When a heart wishes something, there is radiation, and that radiation reacts where you are just in thoughts thinking of it. So as I told you, it is a subject of the heart, not of head. So whoever has got love, love knows service and sacrifice. There is no question high or low. King are the subject. Even the kings are made to sit on the floor as a result of love. So love knows giving away everything, body and soul, surrender, that's a matter of surrender, you see, to somebody's will, to whom you are attached at heart. If your soul is attached to somewhere, then so love is innate in our souls, innate, I would say. God is love in our souls. Are the dogs of the ocean of all love, which is also love personified. But this love knows attachment. The lover soul would have been attached to our soul, God, you see. This has been attached to the physical thing and enjoyments, outward things. That very love is turned into attachment, you see, more. You go where you are attached. Just think within your mind where you are attached, whose love you have got in your heart. You have got love of the worldly things, world. Naturally, you will come in again and again to the world. If you have got love for God or the God in man, then where will you go? Where he will go. If he not going round and round in the wheel of transmigration, how will you go? He comes from the Father and goes back to the Father. He comes with a commission to take souls back to God. So love is love if it is directed to God. Otherwise it is attached. You see? So we have to just think deeply in our heart what we want. We know we have got real love. Real love is no business, mind that. It's no surrender and dedication of everything to Him. How that is developed, whom you love naturally, is sweet to remember always at your heart. And if you want to develop love, then just have a sweet remembrance of Him all the way, all day and night. But the most effective way is to sit by one who is overflowing with the love of God and the intoxication of God. His soul is intoxicated with the love of God. Company, you see? In whatever company you sit, you will have the same radiation. If you sit by a wrestler, by seeing you will have a real love for strength. If you live by some learned man, naturally you will grow love for literary things. And you live, if you sit by somebody who is overflowing with love of God, then naturally you love by radiation love. This is how you get it. But such a man needs nobody except whom he loves. the crown of the Mohammedan saint. For every lover there should be some beloved. We are soul conscious entities. Our beloved should be the oversoul, all consciousness, God. We have made the world as our beloved. Naturally, we come again and again and again to the world. So love should be for God. Dwell that. But that you can dwell only when you sit by in the company, sweet company of God and man who is overflowing with Godhood, hoping the love of God. Then naturally you have by radiation, your soul will be, what you say, injected with love, you see. So love knows service and sacrifice. No will of its own. So I was just speaking of a story of a king who had 4 or 5 wives. In the old days, they were like that, you see. He went out to some foreign land and asked his wives what present they would like he should bring for them. Everyone said something of his own liking. But the youngest was the most lover of the king. She wrote to him, "Well, I want you only, nothing else. You only come back." So naturally when the king came back, he sent all the presents which he wanted by the other wives, and he went to the youngest wife. This is only to show what you really want, that you will be given. You see? There's a saying of the masters, you see, that God has promised to give everything what a man wants, what his soul really desires, really wants. We simply superficially say, "God, we want you," but at the bottom of it, thereof we want worldly things. "Oh Lord, give me this thing, Lord, give me this." It's a business. So you got real love for God at your heart. God will come to you. He will manifest to you. But generally we want only worldly things.
A closing bhajan is Kara Sifataki on page 243. What praise can I do of Guru Kripal, who has made this whole world? After creating the vessels of different colors, he has hidden himself within them. Somewhere becoming healthy, he gives happiness. Somewhere becoming a disease, he creates the turmoil, saying, "Ah, ah," the soul writhes in pain and says, "O Lord, protect us. The pain has bothered us." He himself comes, becoming the doctor and healer. He himself knows the disease which he has caused people to suffer. He himself feels the pulse and diagnoses the three diseases. He himself comes, becoming the herbs of the hills. He himself blows the fire in them. He himself prepares the medicine. He makes the pills and strains the powder. Making the bitter drink, he puts it into the mouth of the patient. He himself swallows it. He himself makes the patient sit up. He himself makes them lie on the floor. He himself, making the play, looks at it. He is present in every cell. Ajib has contemplated his attention towards such kind after taking the orders from Kripal. What praise can I do of Guru Kripal, who has made this whole world? After creating the vessels of different colors, he has hidden himself within them. By John of Sanchi on page 243.
Guru Kripali me जीने को संसार पाने आए रंग रंग दे सज के बंदियानु विचे अपना आप लुकाया कार सिफत की गुरु कृपा दी में जिन्ने कुल संसार बने आए रंग रंग दे सज के बंदियानु विचे अपना आपलुकाया कीते पानर गत सुख देवे कीते रोग बानु दामा मचाए कीते पानर गत सुख देवे कीते रोग बानु दामा मचाए हाय हाय करे तद फांद जाने आपे रब रख लाए दुख सत्याए कार सिफत की गुरु कृपा दी में जिन्ने खुले संसार बने आए रंग रंग दे सज के बंदियानु विचे अपना आपलुकाए आपे पाना तबीब ते वेद आया जाने रोग पे जेदा लाया आपे पाना तबीब ते वेद आया जाने रोग पे जेदा लाए आपे न बाज देखे पार के दोष तीने वत पित बाल काम जो समय आए कार सिफात की गुरु कृपा दी में जिन्ने कुल संसार बने आए रंग रंग दे सज के बंदियानु विचे अपना आपलुकाए आपे पाना पहाड़ ती चाद बूती आपे दातानु फुंका दिखे आए आपे पाना पहाड़ ती जाद बूती आपे दातानु फुंका दिखे आए आपे रास रसायन थे यारे कारे दा वाते गोली ते चूरन चन्ने आए कार सिफात की गुरु कृपा दी में जिन्ने कुल संसार बने आए रंग रंग दे सज के बंदियानु विचे अपना आपलुकाए काद कर के रोग दे मुंग पावे आपे संगति अंदर लागे आए Kad karke roge de munge pave ape sangati andare lagiai ape ut vete vandrogianu Ape dare tite nisala suvayai. Kara sifate ki guru kirpadi me. Jinne kule sansare banne ai. Rang rang de saj ke pandiyanu viche apna apalukayai ape chos vinod pyakar veke Jare jare de vichya samayai Ape chosa vinod pyakar veke Jare jare de vichya samayai Ajaib kirpalida hukamale ke Fere dhyan sach kanda valalayai Kar sifat ki guru kirpaldi me Jin kule sansar panne aai Rang rang de saj ke pande anu Viche apanna apalukayai
He himself making the play looks at it. He is present in every cell. Ajaib has contemplated his attention toward Sach Khand after taking the orders from Kripal. What praise can I do of Guru Kripal, who has made this whole world? After creating the vessels of different colors, he has hidden himself within them. May God bless us all.